WEAF, New York.
The National Broadcasting Company continues its invasion coverage from Washington as we bring you now Morgan Beatty from the NBC Newsroom in Washington. Mr. Beatty.
General Eisenhower's Supreme Allied Headquarters in London tonight reflects the air of optimism that pervades the regular news report. A headquarters spokesman said this at about 7 p.m. London time. Opposition in all quarters was less than expected. Allied naval losses were very, very small. Casualties in the first attacks were less than expected. Coastal gunfire was sporadic. Only 50 German planes were sighted over the invasion coast area in the first 8 hours of assault. Allied planes, for their part, dumped 10,000 tons of bombs out of 7,500 planes, and still the air armadas take off from Britain. There's divided opinion as to why the Germans failed to meet the first wave of Allied forces, the wave that pierced the invasion coast, up to 12 miles on the original thrust. Prime Minister Winston Churchill himself made a careful inspection of all reports tonight, and in London, he said, you remember, he says that the Allies did not achieve tactical surprise, or rather did achieve tactical surprise. This, however, does not mean strategic surprise. There's a difference. For those of us who don't know our military terms, there's a difference between tactical and strategic surprise. What the Prime Minister was saying was this. The Germans knew, because of its nature, our general plan to assault the coasts of Europe. They did not know the time and the place, so they were surprised in a given area, but not in a general way. That's the difference between tactical and strategic surprise in military assault. The Germans, we can now report, had no opportunity to guess the timing of invasion, because General Dwight Eisenhower was the man who set that time. He had it set for Monday, yesterday, and because of bad weather, he changed his mind and put the great assault off for 24 hours. A few minutes ago, here in Washington, Admiral Ernest King of the Navy and General George Marshall and General Henry H. Arnold visited the White House. General Arnold, of course, is with the Air Forces. They discussed war reports with the President. They had nothing to say about their conference with the chief executive when they came out. Only one of the three had anything to say about the invasion itself. Quite fittingly, it was Admiral King of the Navy, the service that helped the Royal Navy put the invasion troops ashore in France. Admiral King shares the cautious optimism of Mr. Churchill. Invasion, he told reporters, is doing all right so far. The others smiled as if in complete agreement. It seems, therefore, at the moment, that cautious optimism is warranted. The Germans did not have the coastal defense system at the point of attack that they should have had, and for reasons that do not appear in the news report at this time. But optimism must be tempered with the realization that the enemy has not yet committed his skilled air force, what's left of it, nor his veteran reserves in Western Europe. He's counting on those reserves for counterattack. But let's go to the Pentagon building across the river from Washington for a military interview that will cover this and other points. Go ahead, NBC Pentagon.
Here in our NBC broadcasting booth in the Pentagon building are two American Army officers who've recently returned from the European Theater of Operations. Both were on hand to witness the final preparatory stages for D-Day. They are Colonel Robert O. Montgomery of the Field Artillery, whose present assignment is at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, and Lieutenant Colonel John R. Ulmer of the Infantry, who is stationed in Washington as assistant editor of the Infantry Journal. Both Colonel Montgomery and Colonel Ulmer went to England as observers for the Army ground forces. Colonel Montgomery, I believe the people at home would very much like to know the extent of the training of our troops for this invasion. You saw many of these troops in England. Can you tell us something about them?
The troops of the Army ground forces in England were either veterans of combat in other theaters or troops that had undergone complete basic unit training in the United States. The troops who had seen combat in other theaters showed extreme confidence in their ability to carry out their missions. They were all anxious to get it over with, to go into combat as soon as possible. Their physical condition was excellent, their morale of the highest.
Now, what about the troops that hadn't seen combat, Colonel? The men fresh from the States?
The troops who hadn't been in combat also had a high order of morale, and their physical condition appeared to be excellent, too. They appeared to be well-trained, insofar as men could be well-trained without actually engaging in battle. I saw at no time any evidence of lack of confidence in their own individual ability or in their leader.
Colonel Montgomery, how much training did these men have that approximated the conditions they are now facing as they land on the European continent?
All the tactical divisions went through the excellent course of training at the United States Army Assault Training Center in England. There they practiced making landings on hostile beaches. The beaches were mined with reduced charges of landmines. They also learned how to move forward to capture objectives several miles from the beach. They worked with full-scale models of concrete seawalls, exact duplicates of the German Atlantic coast defenses which they're up against now.
Colonel Ulmer, it's about time we heard from you. What about the weapons used by our assault forces?
Many types of weapons were probably used. Infantry mortars, chemical mortars, filtratory fire, probably from landing craft, flamethrowers. And in the initial stages, naval gunfire is effective against concrete fortifications.
Colonel Montgomery, do you have anything to add on that score?
Well, concrete emplacements may be attacked in various ways. By rocket fire from launchers mounted on medium tanks, by point-blank artillery fire from 155-millimeter guns and those of higher caliber, and by engineering methods. By pushing explosives up against the wall, by tanks, or placing them there by hand.
And, of course, by bombing operations from the air. Planes can hurt concrete fortifications if they hit them at a crucial point, but I think aviation will be used to harass enemy supply lines and to strafe enemy troops.
Well, what about the possibility of an early German counterattack? Colonel Montgomery?
We can expect local German counterattacks at any time, but a concentrated, coordinated German counterattack will probably not take place until the German high command feels sure they know where the principal Allied effort is being made.
Colonel Ulmer, how about a word for your special field of interest, the infantry, the humble doughboy?
Thousands of tons of equipment and gear were shipped to England. Hundreds of specialists had to do many small tasks, but their only purpose was and is to get the man with the rifle forward, the infantryman. He's the guy who's going to win this operation. From General Eisenhower on down, the idea is to get the man with the rifle forward. He may travel by air or on a boat, but when he wins this thing, he'll do it on his own 2 feet.
Well, there's more to an infantryman than just a man with a rifle. Isn't that right, Colonel Ulmer?
Yes. Today's infantryman fights not only with a rifle and bayonet, but with mortars, cannon, carbines, automatic rifles, light and heavy machine guns, and grenades. An infantry regiment has at least 15 different weapons, but all of them are only to get that doughboy with the rifle in his hand forward.
And how about a last word from you, Colonel Montgomery?
I believe, and I know Colonel Ulmer agrees, that the American Army taking part in the invasion today is the best equipped and best trained American Army that has ever entered the initial stages of combat.
Thank you, Colonel Robert Montgomery and Lieutenant Colonel John Ulmer. Now back to Morgan Beatty.
Thank you, Holly Wright, Colonel Montgomery, and Colonel Ulmer. There are 2 points there that I think will bear repeating. The point of the fact that this army that's attacking the coast of Europe today is the most experienced army of its kind in history. That sounds strange, coming as it does from a nation that has not been at war and has not planned for war for many years. But you must remember that this is amphibious attack in a modern way, and we are more experienced in amphibious attack in all parts of the world, the British and ourselves, than any other armed forces. And then that other point about the infantrymen. The other day, Admiral Cochrane came to this studio and with me pointed out the very important thing that infantrymen must take real estate before anything can happen in the way of victory in warfare. A couple of hours ago, I sat in the Senate with a group of our lawmakers discussing invasion. Some of them went on the air to express their feelings to you and what they were thinking. I've never seen the lawmakers of the nation in quite the mood they expressed today. Senator Alvin Barkley sat silent in his chair. The majority leader, the leather-lunged orator, was not in an oratorical mood. But he came to the microphone and said just about what any boy's father would say, and then his mind went back to the hymns of childhood in old Kentucky. Like all of the rest of us, Senator Barkley seemed to sense that this is a supreme moment in history. The men and women who must carry us through now are at their battle stations. They've already begun to take part in the greatest military effort of all time. The combined effort more nations than you can count on your fingers and toes are making. All of us share hopes and fears for these brave men, but there are people in the background, millions of them, who've done more than just hope, more than fear. They represent the spirit of people generally in the allied world, civilians in the rear rank, you might say. There are people like Mary Galasso, whom I met in England more than a year ago, a second-generation British girl of Italian descent, a girl from Liverpool. And in a short year's time, Mary Galasso won her way from complete obscurity to a place on the envied 1,000 crew of girls who aimed the deep-throated anti-aircraft guns in the darkness at Hitler's blitzing planes over England. Mary was a poor toy factory girl who wanted to do something big for Britain. So she got a job in the ATS, the Women's Auxiliary Army, the British version of the WACS over here. And Mary mastered the radar control system, and when I saw her in Britain, she was the champion calculator of her gun emplacement in the London zone. Mary's 33, unmarried, and she wants to make a career out of Britain's guns. And she's tending one of those guns today on Invasion Day. Another great woman in Britain is Grandma Peg. Mrs. Mary Peg is her real name, who's turning out airplanes or helping to in her 79th year. I get up, she says, at 6 o'clock and come home at 7 in the evening, but it's worth it to smash Hitler. And I almost left out the telephone operator in London who lost both arms in the original Blitz. She's 18, and after she had lost her arms, she had the burning ambition to return to work. So officials of the Ministry of Pensions sent a limb manufacturing mechanic around to her hospital, and he spent months on the job. There's a special gadget now on her right arm, a sort of extension, and a billiard cue rest for the other arm. Mechanical bits and pieces, they say in Britain, enable this girl to dial phones and plug in cords. And she's on the job today for invasion, freeing another worker for more vital war work. Here in America, the pressure for woman power to fill out the gaps, piece out the manpower, is not so great. Even so, Fritz Reiner of the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra has taken on 18 women. Two of these women played the stringed bass, usually reserved for men. Few of us realize how important it is to carry on with the regular affairs of everyday life in wartime, especially in these critical hours, so long as we do not impair the tempo of the battle. These 18 women in Pittsburgh are doing their part. Then there's George Walkham, a junior of Chicago, and his neighborhood gang. They set out a few weeks ago to collect waste paper to help win the war. George's three little sisters, between 6 and 10, were the advance agents. They scouted out new sources of supply through the neighborhood. George and his brother, George Cortelette, they're 12 and 13, were the heavy men with the wagon, the Walkhamer's little red wagon. And in 4 days, working after school and evenings, these children collected 4,622 pounds of waste paper. Mrs. Walkhamer was surprised and curious about all this sudden industry. What inspired the campaign, and when would it end, she asked. And sure enough, there was a plan. George and his gang wanted money. Yes, money for model plane kits, George's favorite hobby. But the kits were going to wounded soldiers in a hospital in the nearby neighborhood. And then there's the tragic side of civilian work in war. In Silver Spring, Maryland, near Washington the other day, a funeral procession drove slowly away from the mortuary. It was just like any other funeral, you'd think. They were burying Mrs. Lorraine B. Chandler, a 21-year-old Navy bride of 8 months. Nobody would have known that Mrs. Chandler was a war hero. Nobody fired any salutes. Nobody played taps. But she was a war hero, for Lorraine Chandler died in the Bureau of Standards in Washington. She was blown through a second-story window in an explosion. The details cannot be told until after this war has passed us by. All they'll say over at the Bureau of Standards is that Lorraine was working with four other scientists, most of them youngsters like herself, on an urgent war project to make our aviation gasoline better, the very gasoline that is propelling the planes on Invasion Day. And we're told they did make aviation gasoline better. But Lorraine Chandler might as well have died on the battlefield or in an airplane like the Colin Kellys and all the others who won the Congressional Medal of Honor. Because, after all, it takes 120 civilians to make a war, as well as 10 million brave fighting men. And some of these civilians, a few, give their lives too. That's all for now, and thank you. I'll be back tomorrow at this same time.
You've heard Morgan Beatty from the NBC newsroom in Washington and his analysis of the invasion news. We also heard from Colonel Robert Montgomery and Colonel Ulmer speaking from the huge Army Pentagon building across the Potomac River from the nation's capital. Morgan Beatty is heard over most of these same stations every weekday, Monday through Friday, from the NBC newsroom in Washington. Tomorrow, at this same time, keep up with the news with Morgan Beatty. This is the National Broadcasting Company.